Hello, I'm Ben Diamond, inventor of consumer products. And in this podcast series, Why the Fork, we're exploring products you touch every day but take for granted and ask why great engineers and designers invented them, why they were inspired, why politics, economics and social change encouraged them to find new solutions, and why the ones we've ended up with are only good enough. Plus, we'll be hearing from the next generation of designers and engineers to see what's the future. Will they evolve or disappear? This is a podcast by D2M Product Design, and I'll be quizzing Phil Staunton, our design expert, later. Now you join me in a crisis. Our washing machine has broken. There's water on the floor and a ton of washing to do. And as I sift through the pile to find something that's clean enough to wear, it got me thinking, why the fork? Why do we have washing machines? Who invented them? Where did they come from? Why are there not statues to the innovators and engineers that created them? Why the washing machine? Given its impact on the world and our wardrobes, you would have thought the inventor of the washing machine would be as famous as Edison or Steve Jobs. But this simple machine has not been celebrated. In 2009, a publication associated with the Vatican described this machine as being the thing that emancipated more women than the pill. We hope they were kidding. It's one of the most complex products we're covering on our podcast, but it has such a massive impact on our lives and on our society that we feel it deserves its own episode. Traditional washing of clothes was done by hand at streams, often as a group, and in early cities in the Industrial Revolution, in laundry houses, both for housewives to bring their laundry to, and professional laundries for the upper classes and businesses. Washing was often done on a Monday, as the air was cleaner from the smoke of the factories, having had Sunday off. It was an incredibly time-consuming task. For the earliest machines for washing, we need to go back to the 17th century. The first recorded machine is in 1677, where Sir John Hosking's device was referred to in the diary of the famous scientist Robert Hooke. This was for a cord bag to us ladies' delicate fabrics. 1691, John Tizak patents the first machine, and although we don't really know what it was, it's likely to involve the beating of laundry, which was commonly done either with wooden panels or on rocks to help move soap and water and remove stains. And it was aimed at an industrial process, nothing like our domestic machines. Then, in 1752, we see, in the Gentleman's Magazine, the Yorkshire Maiden. Perhaps not the most politically correct name, but this wonderful innovation looks like the bottom half of a barrel with a lid on. You fill this with hot, soapy water, and then you put a dolly in, which is a bit like a broom with a three-legged milk stool on the end, through a hole in the lid. The tub's walls have paddles of vertical slats of wood that, between them and the movement of the dolly, agitate the washing. This creates a turbulent wave-like flow to move the washing through the water and the soap through the fibres, helping them to clean. It significantly sped up washing, with multiple shirts at the same time, using less water, less fuel and less effort. The Yorkshire Maiden was a transformation in our ability to wash, and whose influence can still be seen in our top-loader-style machines today. But we have no idea who was the inventor of the original design. I suspect there were multiple people doing similar inventions, improving how tubs are used and taking existing products like the millstone and adapting it for this purpose. But then something very interesting happened. You see, good ideas, well, they travel. And the hero of our story is Jacob Christian Schaefer. Now, he's a Bavarian German, a bit of a polymath, but basically a really cool scientist. And he took the Yorkshire Maiden, which had been improved slightly in places like Denmark, and he wrote about it in a pamphlet. That was then translated from German to French and eventually spread throughout the world. In fact, the reason we know about it is largely because of an Israeli archive from America. He said, "How can we do laundry with no soap, no boiling water, no special heating, no wood nor fire, no washerwoman, no repeated soaking, or even noticing that you're doing laundry?" What great Schaefer marketing. This is like the early social media gushing about this transformational device, and he helped spread the ability of people to wash clothing throughout the world, whether he intended to or not. And we see the Yorkshire Maiden being used and adapted in different countries. It led to people like Henry Sidger in 1782 inventing better and improved versions based on butter churns that allowed the washing itself to be moved in multiple directions. And in 1790, Thomas Todd, an organ builder from Leeds, made a crank machine for washing by hand. And he and Edward Beetham is where we really start to see these machines taking off, with great marketing being done by Beetham and Todd, until they split up, you know, boy bands, selling over 1,000 portable washing mills in places as far afield as Colchester, Yarmouth and Ipswich. He even got endorsement from Captain Cook for the Navy. So, sounds like the washing machine was invented in Yorkshire, perfected in Denmark, talked about in Germany and French, and then shipped off to America. And then the first patent in the US, 5 years later, was Nathaniel Briggs. But we don't know much about this, because the patent office burnt down 40 years later, and with it, his drawings. James King and Hamilton Smith in the 1850s are widely regarded as the birth of the modern washing machine, with rotating drums and the beginning of heating. King's had a horizontal rotating frame which sat over a pool of water heated by a coal fire, like our front loaders today. This used less water, heat and soap than the top-loading style of the Yorkshire Maiden. By the end of the 1890s and the beginning of the 1900s, mechanised mechanical versions of the previous machines were made. Now we can introduce a brand you have heard of, Millais, who have rotary drums with fires underneath that allows the cranking of washing and the heating of water at the same time. A massive step change. These industrialists and early brands could see how the mechanisation of industry, like weaving, could be applied to the domestic and labour-intensive world of laundry. They allowed washing of multiple shirts at the same time, speeding up the process and reducing the cost and amount of soap. But washing is such a big task that I suspect that our historic record is just a bit skewed. I think that the Yorkshire Maiden and many of the other early innovations happened simultaneously in many countries, and that if you dived into Denmark or Portugal or some of the other industrialising nations at the time, you'll see early mechanised machinery in washing everywhere. Surprisingly, the Chinese, who are always very far ahead in many technologies, didn't mechanise washing. That's why Schaefer's pamphlet is so important. It helps spread a great idea throughout the world. Without it, we wouldn't have seen new designs. With this wonderful contraption, wouldn't everyone have wanted to have one in our home? Well, no. Firstly, they're expensive, the price of a modern car, and really designed for industrial-scale laundry, early washhouses. And here, the employees were, well, you guessed it, women. There were not many trades where women were allowed to work. But of course, these new machines needed less workers and could be operated by cheaper labour. That means children, who, you know, cost less and could easily be replaced when you broke them. Yeah. Now, there were no laundry riots, but like the demonstrations in the cotton trade, you might have heard of Peterloo, workers did not want these new machines. New innovation often puts existing skilled people out of work, just like our worries about AI today. Despite that resistance, these early machines significantly reduced the amount of time and increased the amount of washing that can be done. The first modern automatic washing machine designed specifically for the home was Alva J. Fisher's Thor in 1907. An electric motor sits below a rotating drum, allowing you to fill that with hot water from your taps. Now, there's a few caveats to this. Those early electric motors weren't insulated, which meant they blew up. And you needed to have both running water and an electrical supply. And in 1900, most homes didn't have them. But the Depression and both the First and Second World Wars significantly reduced the demand and its development of domestic machinery. Unlike many other technologies, in warfare, the humble washing machine was just not important as the world focused on fighting. But by the 1950s, running water and electricity was in many people's homes, and it was now possible to have domestic washing machines.
You know, the new RCA gives you two speeds as well as two adjustable time cycles. Just set the dial for normal wash and automatically you'll get the right speed for sheets, towels, blue jeans and your everyday laundry. You just talk to a woman who uses an RCA, then see your RCA dealer. Ask him to show you the new two-speed RCA washer.
Till then, a lot of the machine washing was done in laundries, sometimes co-located near swimming baths, built by councils to address hygiene and cholera and sharing hot water. This is really where the boom of the washer and the fridge and the other domestic appliances came from. But early machines weren't necessarily fixed. To plumb them in, you would wheel them out and stick sucker hoses onto your taps in either a scullery or a kitchen. You would fill them and you'd have to manually turn the machines on and off, often moving washing from the wash tub to a mangle to wring out. Okay, now go and sit in front of your washing machine. In Europe, it will be a front loader, either in the bathroom or the kitchen, and they're more common here. They're more efficient, but have a longer wash cycle and are more expensive than the top loaders used in North America in dedicated laundry rooms. But they basically work the same. You can see the water filling in from the top mixed with the detergent. And, like Kings and Millet, the rotating drum turns washing clothes. You can see the paddles, which work just like those in the Yorkshire Maiden, with its dolly, agitating the clothes and getting the detergent into fibres and the dirt out into the water. The detergent is very clever, breaking down different types of stains with smart chemistry and holding it into the water. Unlike the old machines, these are really efficient. A very small amount of water, electrically heated in the base and sloshed around. No more massive filling of tubs. Like the Thor, the motor at the bottom drives the whole thing, but these are more powerful and electronically controlled, measuring weight, spin speeds and time. And once drained, it's rinsed several times. The last one with fabric conditioner that leaves your clothes fresh smelling and feeling soft before the very fast spin. This spinning creates a massive amount of force. So there's a lump of concrete and a suspension system that keeps it all central and stops it walking across the room. Those 60s machines were renowned for starting in one corner and walking over, pulling the hoses out with the water all over the floor. So why are there not statues to the great inventors of the washing machine? In fact, this machine is so neglected that when you visit the London Science Museum, where is the washing machine? Is it next to the steam engine or the Apollo capsule? No, it's hidden in the basement next to the picnic tables. Probably one of the most important inventions in human history, and it has very little regard. It's transformed people's lives, but perhaps not in the way we really imagined. We're still doing just as much time-consuming laundry. We're just doing more of it. More colours, more materials, more material types. It has not truly freed us up. What the washing machine really has done is allowed us to wash more frequently. Instead of being restricted to a single wash day, we can do it more often. It may not have revolutionised who does the washing, but it's revolutionised the fashion industry. And it is still way beyond automation. Every CES, there'll be another robot promising to solve the laundry problem. But it's an incredibly complex challenge to be able to handle t-shirts of different sizes and colours. I mean, I can't even sort my kids' socks correctly, let alone what setting my delicate jumper needs to be on. So what might the future look like? There's some exciting new technologies. Ultrasonics, plastic absorbing beads, microplastic filters, and my favourite, super critical carbon dioxide. Think dry ice instead of water. It can clean delicate garments, removing chemical stains without damaging it. And in our home, the best thing about it is that the wash comes out totally dry, halving the time to do laundry. These new step change technologies are expensive for a machine that only costs £500. And washers are normally an impulse purchase, only bought when, if like mine, they stop working. As for me, I don't know what to do. Do I try and fix my broken machine myself, or do I call someone out, or just buy a new one? Either way, the washing machine doesn't deserve to be hidden in the basement of the Science Museum. It's such an important part of our lives that it should be lauded for its impact. There are no statues to the inventors, because so many of them contributed. This was not an overnight revolution, but incremental changes over 350 years to the tools available at the time, from butter churns to electric motors, and great influences like Schaefer, or the sexist adverts of the 50s, showing how it would improve our lives. It hasn't freed up women, but it has transformed family life, allowing us to be more hygienic and wear more beautiful clothes. I'd now like to bring in Phil Staunton, our design expert from D2M. Phil, what did you think about our story today?
Fantastic story. Fascinating as ever. Can't believe that Yorkshire is in there again as the home of invention.
I'm not biased. Guys, I'm originally from London. I'm only pretending to live in Yorkshire.
We should share with the listeners how we choose these topics for these podcasts and which kind of products we're going to look at. Obviously, one of the criteria is it's got to be something that generally most people touch every day, right? I'm just wondering if there's behind the scenes, you have a criteria of if it was invented by a Yorkshire person, then it goes right up the list and says we've got to do that one.
I'm just trying to belong. But you're right. Like, what is surprising is where these innovations are coming from. And we didn't know when we set out to the washing machine or the hair straightener, the other one that kind of was invented around here, as to where they came from. And I think there's an inherent bias in the stories that we're picking up. I think we're mainly picking up things that developed in the West, partly because of the patent literature. I think that's true. And I think with the washing machine especially, the fact that the Yorkshire Maidens is famous isn't because it was the first washing machine. It was the first one to be talked about, in this case by Schaefer. And that's why it's well known. I suspect it was invented in lots of different places. And you're hearing the toothbrush, you know, it's invented in loads of different places around the world. It's just who had the first patent seems to be the one that becomes the inventor. So there's no bias, guys. I promise. I'll just make sure.
One of the other things that jumped out at me is that a lot of these inventions, they don't really happen until like the 1900s when like educated middle classes or trades people are doing the task and therefore start inventing something to kind of make it easier. But obviously with this one, actually, it started way before that. There's quite a lot of development, even though one suspects most of the people doing the washing were actually, you know, servants and that type of thing who kind of weren't educated. So I wonder if you had a view on why the washing machine particularly was actually kind of invented quite a lot earlier.
Yeah, I think this is a fascinating question. And I think this ties into the early Industrial Revolution. So I think wash houses were factories. You need to think of them as factories. And if you go to a modern commercial laundry, they run like a factory. So the industrials at the time saw it in the same way that people were seeing coal mining or steel making or cotton development. They saw it as an opportunity to mechanize, industrialize, and make the process cheaper and more efficient. I don't think they ever saw it as a way to emancipate women. They certainly didn't see it as a domestic washing machine in everyone's home. It's a bit like, you know, the computer, you know, the IBM quote where there's maybe a market for 5 computers in the world. They saw it as an industrial machine. They didn't see it as, you know, having one in your pocket as you do today. And that, I think, is the real hit. It's also, I think, where there was some resistance, you know. You're coming in here with this newfangled AI technology and taking our jobs, and particularly jobs from women where there isn't many opportunity to do to work. And that's why it's such an interesting story. It's not a case of somebody sat down and said, let's invent a domestic washing machine that's going to mean that housewives in the 1960s can suddenly read books instead of doing their laundry.
That kind of came across, I think. And as you say, there was something like the tin opener. There's no kind of factories of people opening cans. There's no kind of factory owner going, how do we make this more efficient? Because there were those industrial wash houses, then people were going, heck, how can I employ half a number of people and still wash twice as many clothes? So I guess that's the kind of key difference, isn't it? It's an industrial application.
Exactly. But I loved your point about the education. So the people doing these mundane tasks, and we're picking mundane products, remember, in this podcast, like Why the Fork is all about the everyday products. They're not necessarily people until very recently who could do the inventive step. They didn't know how to do it. They haven't got access to capital. They might not have had the education. And that's definitely very, very true. But I think that's why, as designers and engineers, we've got to always be looking for those cool new problems. People aren't going to come up to you and say, by the way, I've got a problem in opening my tin can. Or, you know, what would be great is the ability to sort socks every day. You know, it's our jobs to kind of ask those awkward questions and find out, you know, and then invent the solution, I think. So, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. That's where kind of like quite a lot of the market research and consumer insight stuff comes in. And I'm always surprised, but probably shouldn't be, quite how much particularly large organizations pay for market insight. But actually, that's the key thing, right? If you've got a genuine need that everyone wants to solve and is prepared to spend money, and that's the critical bit, prepared to spend money to solve, then you know, there's a fantastic business opportunity there. You can get ahead of your competitors, you can create a new category and all that kind of stuff. So, but again, quite a lot of the clients who come to us, I guess, don't really realize that. They don't realize that they need to be solving a genuine need that, that people are prepared to pay for a solution.
It always surprises me how few companies talk to their actual consumer. So whatever your industry is, have you spoken to the person who's going to be using your product or the person who's got the problem? And it doesn't have to be massive market research like the big companies do. It can be, have you asked your mates? I've got on my phone, because I'm quite fascinated about laundry, like a little discussion guide. I ask people about their washing, and it's quite surprising what people tell you about who does the washing in their family, how much they do, how often they do it. You know, do you wash your pajamas every day? And I mean, like, that came out of just talking with friends. No, he's like, I don't, but I have families who do. And I think that don't be afraid of asking your consumer or your customer, and you buy them a cup of tea or an Amazon voucher or pay them, or it doesn't matter. It's such an important thing to do before you kind of come up with an invention.
And the other thing we suggest is look at the reviews of your competitor products, or look at the reviews of the closest thing that might vaguely solve the problem. You know, see what everyone's saying, what's good and what's bad about those kind of solutions. Interestingly, we had a particular client in the sports and leisure sector. I won't go any more on that because we're fairly obvious who it is. And the MD basically said to us, no, I want to talk to our customers about this new product that we're investing £500,000 in terms of the tooling and the development and the marketing and the launch. I know what I like. My customers always bought what I liked previously. I like black and red. Make it black and red.
But this is the thing. You mustn't design for yourself. Like, you know, you and I have both designed for hundreds of different people. And, you know, a middle-aged, middle-class, slightly geeky, you know, product. It's a tiny market. You want to be designing for people that you're not. And if it's not whether you like the product, it's whether your customer and consumer likes the product. That's absolutely
true, that's the thing. And this guy, even being, you know, CEO of a successful company, having sold tens of thousands of products, the point is, yeah, but how many more would you have sold if you didn't just design it for yourself? And actually, the important person here is who hasn't bought your product because they didn't like it, not who has because they like what you like.
With something as complex as the washing process, and the washing machine's only like a small part of this, how would you approach trying to make it better for families? And we're going to talk later about people who don't even have access to kind of clean water and washing machines themselves. How do you approach it from a design point of view?
There's lots of things, really. You know, one is exactly that, trying to discover what the genuine real need is. You know, in this case, it's pretty obvious, right? It's lost productivity. No one really likes washing. so you know, clearly there's a genuine need there. I think the commercial viability comes in really early on. And actually, I think you kind of touched on that to a degree, and we probably will kind of going forward talk about the future of it. Yeah, there are solutions that, you know, with kind of AI sorting socks or whatever it is, robots doing the laundry, but they're not in everyone's home because they're just way too expensive for most people to actually afford. And what one of my real bugbears as a design agency owner is when people come to us with a solution that's being developed by another design house, and I take one look at it and I go, this is going to cost £50 to make. You have to sell it for £250, and the maximum price anyone's going to pay for it is more like 100. Now, I made some assumptions there, and obviously the person's free to go and test those assumptions. But the point is, really, this kind of designer, let's make an amazing looking concept. Oh, wouldn't it be great if it had titanium detailing and all this kind of thing? It's got to be commercially viable. Otherwise, all you're doing is wasting the poor client's money.
It really surprised me, actually, you know, having been inside my washing machine quite a bit recently, how much technology is in that machine. And it's only £500. I mean, that's a lot of money, but you compare it to a car, a house, or a plane. So being able to innovate that next jump is going to be really challenging for any piece of new technology. Why do you think, though, that some industries, and we talked previously about the hair straighteners, have been able to do a massive price jump and been able to put that technology on? What is it that's enabled them to kind of do that jump?
And I think the hair straighteners is a slightly different case because, you know, it's a brand new product category and people haven't got a price expectation of what they should be paying for it. And I think it's a lot harder in washing machines because, you know, a lot of people think like, well, I only pay £200 for a washing machine or I only pay £500 for a washing machine. So if you suddenly bring in a whole load of technology and it's £2,000, they don't even look at it. It's not about, is that technology great? It's like, that's out of my price category, you know, and it doesn't even come up in the filters they're putting into the website or anything else. Whereas the hair straighteners, you know, you didn't have that because no one knew what to spend on it. And I think also with the hair straighteners, it kind of comes back to that Rachel from Friends point, right? You know, you suddenly got this massive outside influence and people going, I want to look like that. And I didn't really mind what it's going to cost me. But with the washing machine, it's very different, I think. Because it's like, my current washing machine is broken. What am I, you know, almost first question, what can I afford? I need to buy one now. What's available now? And what can I afford? It's not that kind of aspirational purchase in the same way that something like a hair straightener is.
So now I would love to talk more about the future of the washing machine. And it's a real privilege to introduce Laura Tuck, who's the R&D lead from the Washing Machine Project. Hello, Laura.
Hi, Laura.
Hi. Great to be here.
Welcome to Why the Fork. First, tell me a little bit about yourself. You are an engineer, so, you know, you're qualified to be here.
Indeed I am, yeah. So I'm currently R&D lead at the Washing Machine Project, as you mentioned, but my background's actually in manufacturing engineering. It's what I studied at university and what really got me into the engineering industry, a real passion for how things are made.
Tell me, the Washing Machine Project is something particularly special and I'm genuinely thrilled that you could join us today. Tell us a little bit about it, where it originated and the impact it's having throughout the world today.
Yeah, so the Washing Machine Project is set up to alleviate the burden of hand washing clothes. So there's definitely a perception in places like the UK that everyone has a washing machine, that's just how it's done. But that's actually a very privileged minority of people have access to a washing machine. About 60% of the world's population, 5 billion people, still wash clothes by hand. And that's a really labour-intensive, painful, difficult task that predominantly falls on women and children. So we've designed a manual washing machine that uses no electricity or water to enable people in lower-income communities to access washing machines and have some of those same opportunities with the time that it frees up, as we do here in the UK.
One of the things I noticed about the Divya washing machine is that the original design, some of the early designs had cogs and gears and they were quite complex. And then in the latest version, you've stripped them right out and it's a flat pack product. It's very simple. It can be built with any tools. Why did you decide to do that? What's the advantages for that, both for you guys and obviously for the end user?
Yeah, so when I first joined the company 3 years ago, we had a predominantly plastic design and we built 30 of that design to trial in Uganda. And I actually took them to the end location. And that really hit home why it wasn't the right design for our users. So in order to get there, we kind of had to fly to Kampala, travel for multiple hours down to Lake Victoria. And then we were on a fishing boat for about 4 hours trying to get these machines to an island where we then didn't have electricity, didn't have phone signal, and we dropped off this plastic product.
It was big, wasn't it? Like it's the size, yeah. The original one was the size of a, you know, domestic washing machine at home. So you're trying to do this on trucks and carts in hand luggage.
We saw people trying to get them on the back of tuk-tuks and motorbikes and all of that kind of stuff. So it really brought home the challenge with maintenance and repairability as well. So it's not just getting them to the end location. In transit, one of those machines that the catch had broken, it was a 3D printed part, and couldn't repair it.
No 3D printers in Lake Victoria.
Access to a 3D printer. Yeah. We couldn't get Royal Mail to drop anything off. There wasn't, you know, a postal service that was running daily. So we really looked into what skills existed in those communities, and there was a lot of ability with metalwork. So we decided to move to a metal machine, because then if anything does break, they have the skills and resources to be able to rework the metal components, unlike when things are, you know, tooled out of plastic or 3D printed. And we decided to make it fully disassemblable. So with a set of spanners and a set of Allen keys, you can take it all apart. which means it can be maintained through life, but also then at end of life, you've got a load of flat metal sheets that can be made into, you know, whatever you have the skills to repurpose it into.
So Laura, can you just explain for everyone, you know, how it works if there isn't any electricity? And did you say it doesn't use any water either?
It does use water, but it uses about half the water of hand washing clothes. So it works very similarly to the washing machine you may have at home if you've got a front loader. So it's a drum within a tub, but instead of having a motor that turns it, we have a direct drive hand crank. So you just spin it and then leave it to soak and spin it again. So our wash cycle, the standard cycle, is 30 minutes long, but you're only actually turning the handle for 6 minutes. We really utilise the soaking time to try and remove some of the tougher stains. But it just works like a standard front loader, moves the clothes around to create that mechanical agitation, which helps clean the clothes.
And does it use detergent?
It does, yeah. But that's a big design challenge for us, actually, because there's so many types of detergent around the world. What's very common in some of our locations is hand wash powder, which actually behaves quite differently to the kind of powder you'd put in a washing machine, because it's used to different agitation styles. But we also get people who hand make their own soap. We have people who use bar soap. We have people using liquid detergent. So we've really had to think about the design to work with whatever can be accessed in some of these remote locations where there isn't an alternative option.
Is there a market for it in the Western world? It's just, I'm looking into quite a lot of sustainable housing projects, particularly in kind of Wales and places like that. Where people are actually trying to live off-grid or live with much lower carbon footprint and that type of thing. So is that a potential, or is it really just aimed at developing countries?
So we do get requests from places like the UK, the US, Europe, for people who are aiming for that kind of off-grid lifestyle, or even just trying to reduce their electricity bills. And there is a market of people that design manual washing machines for backpackers or van lifers, but they're usually much smaller capacity. Our priority is really the people who don't have the option of using electricity. So it's not something we've explored in great detail, but we have had some trials in the UK and there's definitely appetite.
I wonder what we can learn, though, from your design. So the fact that you've chosen to have every component disassemblable by the end user and then recycled into other things at the end of its life. Whereas if I think my washing machine, I had to take apart with a Torx screwdriver and, you know, it was £500 worth of parts for the sake of what turned out to be a tiny plastic component. Are there things that you guys can teach designers like Phil so that when we're thinking about future projects or future products, we consider the full life cycle much, much, and repairability much easier?
I do think there's some relatively obvious things that we've done. It's not really reinventing the wheel, but the large majority of things we've done are an M6. So you give someone one spanner and suddenly they can access almost all parts of the machine, which isn't reinventing the wheel. But a lot of what we've done is be context considerate. So things like the using the stainless steel is because of the metalwork that we were seeing that was prevalent in those locations. When we're talking about places like the UK, the recycling infrastructure is completely different. So the optimal solution might be something where it makes more sense for it to end up at a factory or a recycling centre. But I do think that careful consideration of the context around it is very important. If you're designing for somewhere like the UK that has the infrastructure, you don't have to limit yourselves to solutions that only use an M6, because in some instances that's over-engineering. But being really considerate of the context you're in, I think, unlocks a lot of great opportunities.
That's awesome. One thing I want to ask you about your design is you put it on wheels, and this really intrigued me. Tell me about, why is it on wheels? Is it to get it shipping easier? What's the reason behind that?
Yeah, so we actually, in the first instance, we put wheels on because we didn't know how people would use the machine, because it was such a big behaviour change. We weren't sure if they'd want to move it. So we put them on so that we could do a survey at the end and say, do you like the wheels on it? In a slightly less leading way. And it turns out everyone used them. And it's unlocked all these really interesting use cases where people are taking the machine and wheeling it to their neighbour's house so their neighbour can use it for the day. And we've inadvertently created these communities where 5 or 6 households are sharing this machine and they'll each have a day. Or it lives by the well, so everyone in the community can access it, and then it just gets wheeled into someone's home at night for security. And we didn't necessarily intend that at the beginning.
You planned that.
But I think that's a really interesting thing. And when we talk about sustainability and behaviour change as well, communal access to resources is a really interesting way to look at it. If that was more common.
Because historically, like when we were doing our study, particularly in the 50s, 60s, 70s, as early electric machines came out, they were in wash houses. So you'd go to your local laundry, which is often co-located with a swimming bath or something like that, and you would do the washing together. And it was a very social experience. But also, from an efficiency point of view, that machine's being used all the time. And it feels like the experience you're having is exactly the same, but with much more refined designs, you know, a much more efficient design than you've created. What do you guys feel is the future of washing then? And because we focus very much on the washing machine, and there's a lot more. There's drying, there's folding, sorting my kids' socks is just a nightmare. What's out there that's going to change laundry, and why is it still such a painful experience? Perhaps even why is it still all done by women, you know, mainly women?
So we have actually done some hackathons in the UK, and one of our opening activities is talking about people's laundry journeys, and there are still so many pain points. And now that we've, you know, got rid of so much of the manual labour and washing machines have become a commodity, the pain point is, oh, I've got to sort out my colours, and oh, I can't match my socks, and oh, it's a total pain when the kids get really muddy and I have to do a pre-stain wash. So there is so much opportunity for innovation in the space. But it's always been kind of incremental innovations for the last 100 years, I would say. We haven't had that step change. And I would really love to see a step change either in the technology or the service around it. And there are some apps popping up around the servitization of laundry where someone picks it up for you and then it will get sorted and comes back magically done, which I think is the dream scenario. But obviously
the magic laundry service. It's all sorted and folded and put away in your cupboards. That's what we want, isn't it?
Which would be the ideal. So I think there's that user experience element trying to reduce those pain points. But there's already so many pushes coming from a sustainability perspective. Energy use, water use, microplastics emissions, and the right to repair are all really under scrutiny at the minute. And I think a lot of industries in the kind of home appliance sector have quite a long way to go before they're really at the ideal state.
And what you found then in those is there's incremental improvements in all of them. So there's very smart water filters that can kind of get rid of microplastics. Obviously, there's washing colder temperatures, which is because of better detergents, and the machines are much more efficient. But like you said, it's incremental. But it feels like it's still in this very narrow space, doesn't it? It's just in the washing. It's not in the folding. And there's always a robot CS trying to fold stuff and it breaks and things. So, Phil, have you got stuff to add on that? What's your perspective on washing?
We've been involved actually in various different, you know, washing products and ironing products kind of over the years. And I think the thing is, it sounds initially quite simple. We're going to develop a product that will iron things automatically. But actually, there's so much tiny nuance that needs a human within that kind of process that actually it's just very, very difficult. And that's why you start to see robots doing it, is because those robots are basically trying to mimic a human. Because actually, a human, you know, look at two socks and go, no, they don't match, is really fast. And the human's actually doing a huge amount there that is really difficult to replicate in terms of kind of technology. And it's the same with kind of ironing. If you're trying to develop a product that irons trousers all the time, then that's one thing. But actually being able to then adapt and iron a shirt and iron something else and then not iron something because actually it's delicate and all that kind of stuff. Actually, the human being is really effective at all of those things and very, very difficult to replicate. So I think the future for this product is actually quite hard, and it probably will be small incremental changes.
I mean, no laser washing, no carbon dioxide filling washing machines that instantly drawn and iron your clothes. So
I remember 15 years ago people say, oh, we're not going to wash clothes with water anymore, it's going to be sound waves, and you know, it's like, yeah, that's never happened. So I just I don't know, I'm fairly cynical that there's going to be a big new technology that makes a huge difference, because part as Laura says, there's so many different pressures, the sustainability pressure and the, you know, making it quicker pressure, and then the cost, because people just don't want to spend £4,000 on a washing machine, you know, all of that type of thing. I think it's quite a hard category.
There also seems to be a huge variety, and I think that in our research we found that the volume of washing has increased as the washing machine was invented. And I wonder, Laura, if you've seen that with your consumers, that now they can wash and it only takes 20 minutes instead of 4 hours. Do they now wash more of their saris? Are they washing things they didn't wash previously?
So we haven't found that The longest users of our machine have had the machine for about 18 months so far. And what they're currently doing is doing the same amount of laundry in less time and using that time to do other things. I think if we were to leave it for as long as people have had washing machines in the UK, some of those behavioural and cultural changes might happen. But I think that takes a really long time.
I wish that was true in my house. I feel like 6 wash loads a week is a bit excessive. But I think part of that is also the volume, the type of clothing that we have. So we've got delicates, which you want to wash differently to washing colours. It's a nightmare. It's a nightmare. Washing seems to be a nightmare. Do you guys feel there is a piece of technology that can transform washing? Like, is AI this, which seems to be the solution to everything at the minute out there? Or is it actually we're looking for something much simpler, like you have with the Divya washing machine?
We do see some of the newer technologies creeping into industrial levels of laundry. So things like NFC going on with different sheets being matched and aged when you're talking about industrial laundry, so like a hotel that's washing all of their sheets and wants to know when they get to life and things like that. And AI is starting to creep into some of those solutions as well. So it's happening slowly on industrial scales of laundry. I suppose it could trickle down to household laundry, but I don't think we're at that just yet.
Wouldn't it be brilliant if you could just put your clothes in and the machine knew what to do? I mean, I can't understand the hieroglyphic label. And you're right, in an industrial, you have the little NFC tags. That's the contactless tags. That's like your contactless payment. And they'll be from that, they can tell what that, they can track the individual product, in fact, to find out what it is.
And I loved in your story, Ben, you know, talking about Miele and the fact they've been around now for like 120, 30 years. And we've had a Miele washing machine for like 24 years now, which is quite exciting versus, you know, most of my parents, for example, they seem to have to change their washing machine every 7 or 8 years. And I'm sat there quite smug because, you know, they've been through 3 washing machines in the time that we've been through one. Yeah, I'm just interested, Laura, in your view, is that the kind of way it's going to go in terms of the sustainability thing? I mean, obviously the repairability is going to kind of help potentially with that. But this Miele washing machine, we haven't had anything done to it at all in 24 years, which is, I think, kind of remarkable. So do you think kind of, you know, the durability aspect potentially is part of the future of washing machines? And then I guess the other part of the question is, you know, do you think that people like the design teams for Miele or Whirlpool, which I think the washing machine project is involved with, are they going to be coming to you going, how do you use half the water? How do you get it done in 30 minutes? Is there stuff that they can take from you and learn from going forward?
So the durable angle is definitely what we've gone for. So our machine is designed for 10 years of life. And we just got some life test results yesterday, actually, that we've hit 1.3 times life and it's still going smoothly. So we really aim for it to be used every day for extended periods. 24 years would be the dream. And that's the direction I'd love things to go in, for them not to be repaired at all. That does come at a price premium, though. So there are some, we don't personally charge the end users for the washing machine. We fund that through corporate partners or donations. So for us, that's something that we can manage separately. But trying to convince people to pay for that extra durability is a real challenge. So as designers, trying to get that durability without extra cost is a really big challenge, but something that I think it would be great if more people aimed for. So that warranties of 2 years, you know, why aren't they 10? Why can't we aim for that? And in terms of washing machine manufacturers, we actually have a fantastic partnership with Whirlpool. And we've worked really collaboratively to create the design that we have and to manufacture it at larger scales. So we're able to learn some of the fundamentals of laundry technology from their, you know, over 100 years of history in that space. But from us, we have banks of user research about this current problem space and what users are telling us from 13 different countries, you know, Iraq, Lebanon, Uganda, Kenya, India, Mexico. So we're able to bring those two things together to make something that's really intentionally designed for the users that we're targeting.
We quoted, I think it was a Vatican magazine, saying like the washing machines freed up women more than, you know, anything in history. And of course, we hope they were taking the piss in that. But do you think the washing machine has freed women up, has freed people up?
Yeah, I think it definitely has. And it's not just the washing machine. I think the automation of a lot of household tasks, so washing machines, dishwashers, vacuum cleaners, I'm talking about here, has massively reduced the time that has to be put into unpaid manual labour, which historically and across the world is generally done by women. So I think there's a lot of data that would support that. And we definitely see it with the machines that we use, both with women having more time available. And, you know, they do all kinds of things with that. Sometimes it's relaxing, education. Sometimes it's just other household chores. But to me, that's what empowerment is. We're giving them more choice of what to do with their time. And it also has done something really interesting. And I said for a long time, my dream bit of feedback would be a woman saying she was no longer the primary washer of the household, that it had switched to the man. And we distributed some machines last April in India. And in the 6-month survey, we had two households where that was the case. And wow. For me, that's incredible because it really challenges some of those expectations that are placed on women. And it shares the load a little more fairly.
Laura Tuck from The Washing Machine Project, a massive, massive thank you for all your amazing work. And thank you so much for joining us. Listeners, please do visit thewashingmachineproject.org. You can make donations. You can find out much more about that fabulous work and listen to some of the stories from both the consumers and see the design and development there. And it's in our show notes below. I hope you've enjoyed listening to Why the Fork. Please do like, share. We'd love to make another series. And we need you to kind of tell your friends, tell your boss about our show. And join us on the next episode of Why the Fork.